Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today, December 26, 2010. Today we have a very special program for you, one I regret that we have to have, but one that I think you will enjoy listening to a great deal. Our guest, our speaker, will be the late and great Chalmers Johnson. We'll be airing our final interview we did with Professor Johnson in March of 2010. It will take up the entire hour. I hope you enjoy it. So sit back, relax, enjoy the holidays, and listen to the wisdom of Chalmers Johnson.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
This week, the Federal Communications Commission voted to approve new rules for the Internet. The rules were intended to keep users and innovators free from discrimination by Internet service providers like AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast. Instead, they leave consumers with minimal online protections. Craig Aaron is the managing director of Free Press. He says the new rules just aren't good enough.
I think the biggest problem with these rules, and there are a few good things in them, but overall they're very problematic, and the biggest problem is that it simply doesn't protect wireless Internet users. So those who are connecting to the Internet with a mobile phone or an iPad or another mobile device, the FCC has basically endorsed discrimination. They've given permission to AT&T and Verizon to discriminate, to pick and choose which websites and services are going to work and which maybe won't work so well.
The FCC rules paved the way for a closed system on the wireless web, where the big media companies could dictate how you use the Internet on your mobile device. And there are big loopholes in the rules that allow the big companies and their legions of lawyers to wiggle through and charge users more for less.
We had hoped for a prohibition against what's called paid prioritization. There's some language discouraging paid prioritization, which is this ability of companies to set up toll roads where they'll speed up their service but slow down everybody else. But there's not a strict prohibition. There's not clear language against specialized or managed services, which would be a whole separate lane, not even on the Internet, where companies could build new products and things and stop investing in the open Internet.
Free Press will be closely examining the rules and exploring options to improve them and to ensure rigorous enforcement of the few protections that are in place. Efforts will be redoubled to bring pressure to the FCC and Congress to create rules that reflect the public interest rather than the corporate interest.
It's not real net neutrality, and that means that our fight is going to have to continue until we really secure the protections we need to make sure the free and open Internet stays that way.
For more information about the fight for net neutrality, go to savetheinternet.com.
And now a special commentary from me, your host, Candace Clement. 2010 draws to a close with a decisive victory in a 10-year struggle for communities looking to grab a slice of the local airwaves. In the 11th hour of the 111th Congress, the Local Community Radio Act sailed through the House and the Senate. The bill will open up hundreds of new potential frequencies for licensing low-power FM radio stations. LPFMs are non-commercial, hyper-local radio stations that will be run by nonprofits like community groups, churches, and schools. Because they are so locally oriented, the programming is as diverse as the communities they serve. Tens of thousands of activists and supporters contacted Congress to demand more local radio in our communities. This Herculean effect would not have been possible without the tireless work of the Prometheus Radio Project and countless other organizations and individuals who have been so involved in shepherding this bill to passage. What the bill does is very simple. It removes previous restrictions on the licensing of tiny local radio stations. But by getting this one change on the books, the effects will be massive. Hundreds, potentially thousands of new stations can take to the airwaves. Whether those stations are breaking up the monotony of the FM dial by playing something other than the same old Top 40s format, or are licensed to immigrant communities who are eager to get their own slice of the airwaves to speak to each other in their own language, this bill will change things. I got involved in media reform after working with my own local LPFM station. As a faithful supporter of free speech and diversity of views, arts, and culture, community radio was like a dream come true. I met people I never would have crossed paths with if it weren't for the station. It made me understand where I lived, the challenges we have to overcome together, and the great things happening around me in a way I hadn't before. I've been fortunate enough to work the last 4 years alongside incredible organizers, radio technicians, community media enthusiasts, and policy experts who have been fighting to pass this bill for a decade. And here is a victory that shows the kind of impact fighting for better media policy can have. While it's hard to have such a huge victory followed up only days later with a disappointing outcome on another critical media issue, net neutrality, it should point to what is possible. It took 10 years to win this fight for more local radio, and we need it now more than ever before. When we are organized, we can beat the odds and we can win. So now let's take to the airwaves and keep fighting for more diverse, democratic, and open media.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan an organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today, December 26, 2010, on WILL AM 580. Today we're going to play the final interview we did with Professor Chalmers Johnson, author of the famous Blowback series, the trilogy. And we had Professor Johnson on our show to discuss each of the three books in the trilogy. He was my teacher, and I think the teacher for many Americans, many countless number of Americans, on the nature of American militarism and empire and the huge cost, the huge toll that it has not only on the United States but on the entire world. His final book, which was on the subject of dismantling the empire, America's Last Best Hope, has just been released, and I'd been in conversation with Professor Johnson to have him on the show to discuss the book. We were communicating on that and a number of other matters when his untimely death occurred in late November of 2010. We obviously are not going to be able to have Professor Johnson on to talk about that book, but I urge you all to look at the book if you possibly can and to read it. And in honor of this truly great man, today we're going to replay the interview that we, our last interview with Professor Johnson from March of this year. So with no further ado, let's go to Professor Chalmers Johnson. Thank you very much and happy holidays. Professor Johnson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you indeed. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, you know, I wish I could say there was a long list of scholars writing in the same area as you are.
I do too.
So I know you do. Because I do find it very interesting in its own right that the field of discussing the American overseas establishment empire is largely untouched, at least in popular writings amongst professors and scholars, and certainly untouched among politicians, with just a few exceptions.
The Americans appear to be in deep denial that the world is changing in quite decisive ways. We are no longer number one, whatever that might mean, nor are we able to dictate to the rest of the world, as we have in the past, on what we are trying to do. The world doesn't particularly believe in us anymore. We certainly see this in East Asia, where one of the truly amazing things is to see both China and Japan, India maybe in a slightly different way, emerging as genuinely independent nations, no longer dependent upon precedents from the West.
Professor Johnson, one thing just to touch on that. I think that in most American political discourse from both political parties, and I think in sort of a conventional wisdom among anyone in the news media, is that the United States is, of course, a force for good in the world and the purest country in the world that's most concerned with human rights and democracy, and that no other country equals us. Some get close to us. Those that most agree with us and approve us are of course, close to us, but and we are the best. And I think the general sense is that governments around the world are judged as good governments to the extent they agree with that understanding of the United States. And I'd like you to comment on that also, but also what is in the real world of the people of the world and governments, what is the view of the United States around the world if that's not accurate?
Well, it's a point of view that's very common in America, but it simply doesn't hold up that we're running out of money. We're broke. We are a country that's as deeply in the recession as we are, as deeply indebted as we are, spending somewhere around, once you add it all up in various ways, and this has been done by a lot of different people, so it's not just me, you get a defense budget or a national security budget of around $1 trillion a year in a country that can't afford it. All of this is farcical. The American empire is over. It's known to be over. The Chinese certainly have known it for some time now. Japanese are working hard to figure out a new world for themselves, and they no longer define their goals or the possibilities for their country in the future in terms of American ideas. The American dream, if you will, is a bit passé, and the rest of the world knows it, beginning to know it. It's taking them some time to absorb it, but they're really beginning to know it. And above all, they know that the American Pentagon, the world of the American defense system, our fantastic expenditures on weapons that don't work, this is proving to be farcical.
Chalmers Johnson, in Blowback and in your trilogy and now in the forthcoming book, Dismantling the Empire,
right,
a key part of the argument is this enormous web of U.S. military bases around the world,
yes,
which to this day, I think very few Americans, unless they're actually in the military and involved directly in
right.
this, have any idea that this is going on around the world and how this compares to what other nations are doing. Could you just, for the sake of listeners unfamiliar with this, give an overview, if you would, please, of just what the extent of U.S. military bases is around the world?
Well, there are many different definitions, but taking the simplest, that is the Pentagon's annual base status report, which is an inventory of our military bases, literally that, around the world, not airports or anything else, but military bases with troops on them, that we have well over 700 around the world. No other nation has ever had that many or needs that many. That most of these have built through a process of accretion over time, as are from our various wars, from the Cold War, from our pretense of being a new Rome and dominating the world. They're fantastically expensive. I guarantee you that. They create huge antagonisms in the countries in which they're located. It's a huge majority of the nations in the United Nations know the United States primarily through the presence of American soldiers in their country. We don't know foreigners because of their soldiers in our country. We know them through various other things, above all their products, which we like so much. But it's a military mindset that still dominates our country, dominates our thinking, our belief that if for any reason we should ever not be militarily overwhelming in the face of the rest of the world, that we are then already in decline, not to realize that, in fact, we are already deeply in decline. That is really what's new, that these problems have been building for a very long time. They've now come home to roost, and there's no way to avoid them. That's what I mean by my new book, which is a collection of essays I've written over the past 2 or 3 years, Dissolution of the Empire. I mean by dissolution of the empire, it's time that we do something comparable to what the British did after World War II. Get rid of something we no longer need that doesn't help us, does not contribute one iota to national security, that has a waste of resources, both human resources in the sense of our huge armed forces and and the way in which our scientific endeavors and things of this sort are today so deeply oriented toward military affairs, wars that aren't going to happen, that we couldn't win if we thought we would. It's I don't know quite how to put it, but it's like living in a world that has packed up and moved on.
Our guest, Chalmers Johnson, the author of the Blowback Trilogy and the forthcoming Dissolution of the Empire with Metropolitan Books this summer, one of, if not the leading, certainly in the first tier of experts on U.S. military operations around the world, historically and through to the present day, and a main advocate of, as the new book says, Dissolving the Empire. You've been talking about the extent of the number of bases around the world. I think also the term base doesn't really register for a lot of Americans, especially those who haven't been in the military. They might conjure up sort of a summer camp image of like a barrack with a corrugated tin roof and 100 guys sleeping in bunk beds. What is one of these bases actually like around the world?
Well, of course, disillusion implies that it will happen of its own accord. It won't. What, in fact, we see about these bases is though they often were created with a strategic purpose back in the Korean War or at the end of World War II or in the numerous other wars we have pursued since then. We are building massive numbers of new bases in Afghanistan today. That nothing dissolves of its own accord. That, in fact, they take on a life of their own once they are built. No one is directly in charge of them, but they're an attempt to create something like a rural American community in an utterly foreign neighborhood where the troops have been propagandized in their training, in their preparation for locating in these areas, to believe that they are superior, that the people around them are dependent on them for their security. It's a dangerous, almost Roman kind of view of the world that has developed over time, consequences of the Cold War, of the contest with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was also driven to distraction and ultimately dissolution as a result of trying to keep up with this and keep up with us in this vigorous competition to create bases. They are literally bases. They're run by a military officer from the Pentagon. They are part of the various regional commands that are set up all over the world. The number, say, over 730 is from the base status report, which comes out annually. You could actually run this number up much higher in that it never includes the bases devoted to espionage. There are some bases that are simply not counted by the Pentagon for political reasons. These are particularly ones in places like Israel or some of the bases in the Balkans. Camp Bondsteel, absolutely huge place in Kosovo. It never appears in the base status report for reasons that are unknown to me. But apparently our government simply doesn't want to acknowledge that it uses this base. There often have purposes that go well beyond what they were originally set up for. That is to say, certainly say Camp Bondsteel, for example, is associated with the possibility of building an oil pipeline across the Balkans. But they take on a life of their own. They include, of course, troops, dependents, schools, hospitals, all of the devices that dependents require. They have very large numbers of people. The CIA is invariably there. It's a cancer that will bring us down.
Professor Chalmers Johnson, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580. Our telephone number, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Professor Johnson, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Professor Johnson, I'm wondering, how many other countries in the world have bases outside their own territory that they control like the United States does?
Well, certainly the British did at the height of the British Empire at the end of the 19th century, at the time of, say, the Diamond Jubilee for Queen Victoria. It had maybe 35 to 40 naval bases around the world that allowed them to deploy massive military forces. It was slowly bankrupting Great Britain, as we now know. But even so, the numbers are minuscule compared with the bases that we deploy at the present time. The Russians had some, but that's one of the things that brought the Russians down, particularly in East Europe, where they had bases throughout the former so-called satellites that have been created in the Stalinist era. But generally speaking, people, they do not have overseas bases. In fact, the American military base that we had at Mantra in Ecuador, the president of Ecuador said to the United States, when he asked it to be dissolved, and it has now been eliminated, I'll let you keep it if you'll give me a base in New Jersey or Florida or something like that. And, of course, the Americans didn't even answer. This is the kind of thing that goes on. It's unthinkable that we should accept a Peruvian base in the United States. But there's certainly nothing unthinkable about the fact that we might send some American troops down to Peru to show them how to dig holes.
Well, Professor Johnson, I'm confused. You mean to tell me that China, for example, who is now held up as our main adversary or competitor,
yes,
does not have a series of bases across Asia and South America and Africa?
No, of course not.
It does? Does it have any?
I don't think they would be welcome. No, not that I can think of any. A Chinese military base located, in South America, it's unimaginable.
Well, why do countries put up with this? You just mentioned Ecuador has sort of shut down the U.S. one. It's elected government, the president of which, I might add, studied here at the University of Illinois.
Yes.
Ecuador
is quite good on many of these things, and he's rather funny at times, I think.
But why haven't other countries, said get out of here for the same reason the president of Ecuador said? We don't see what purpose you're serving us.
Primarily, economic relations with the United States. Not that they are that critical or that they couldn't do without them, but that they are there, they're available. There's no reason to antagonize the Americans. The Americans have recently set up an Africa command. Now, this is a military command. It has nothing to do with our needs. But the military is involved here in trying to maintain dominance over a huge area of African nations in order to guarantee future supplies of oil or other minerals that we believe that we can't do without or that we couldn't obtain in some other way than at the point of a rifle. But other nations don't do that. It's not necessary. The Chinese have demonstrated to the world that the resources they need, they can obtain very nicely because they work hard on their economy. They really work on it. They don't just define it. And they've got enough money to go around and simply buy properties, raw materials, things of this sort, around the world. And these create friendly diplomatic relations, of which the Chinese continue to expand them regularly. But they do not do it at the point of a gun. They don't do it through a Department of so-called defense, which is, of course, farcical. They do it in other ways in which they hope, they try to make the relationships reciprocal, that to the extent that they're advantageous to China, they're also advantageous to whatever the place may be, the Congo in Africa or whatever else, where the Chinese are actively investing. That's the way it used to be done. That's the way the Chinese are still doing it. The Chinese are succeeding magnificently at doing this.
Our guest, Chalmers Johnson. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. The phone number again, 333-9455, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Chalmers, author of the famous Blowback Trilogy throughout the last decade, and of the forthcoming book, Dissolution of the Empire, to be published by Metropolitan Books this summer.
Let me just mention, I'm not trying to correct you or anything else.
Okay.
Chalmers is an odd first name. My family name is Johnson.
Yes, Yes, Chalmers Johnson.
Plain ordinary Johnson.
I hope if I left your last name off, I wasn't trying
to.
You were
just mentioning Mr. Chalmers.
Oh, I apologize.
No, perfectly plausible way to put it.
No, I'm well aware of your name, Chalmers Johnson. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line one, you're on with Professor Johnson.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to ask you about Korea specifically, since that's your specialty. And I guess the spring maneuvers have happened again. Maybe 50,000 troops on right up against the DMZ, I suppose.
Hard to believe, isn't it?
Well,
I'm a veteran of the Korean War. That's a long time ago.
The fact that it's never commented on, and a missile firing or any kind of thing is analyzed in depth in the major media, but then the annual maneuvers that happen every year are not regarded as belligerent at all. Of course, we're for peace. So something on that, and then Also, the other aspect of late empire, I think, is mercenaries, and I don't know if other people have covered that, but I don't know if you have anything to say about that. In Latin America, you know, there were arguments about what the ratio of mercenaries to uniformed soldiers were going to be in the Colombia operations for a long time, and since Colombia is our last bulkhead in the region, I thought you might say something about that, and I guess I'll just hang up and listen. Thanks again.
Well, those are good questions. I mean, Korea is very important, but it is, I find it just almost unbelievable to think that how young I was in the Korean War. I'm now 78 years old and beginning to show signs of it. It was ages ago that we were actually concerned about an attack from the north. That's not going to happen. Korea is one of the richest countries on Earth today. It is militarily quite stable. It's a great place for the U.S. Army. They've been there for a long time now. They enjoy having maneuvers. They enjoy testing new weapons that are invented by various characters in favored districts in which congressmen do everything to make sure that they're happy in order to get reelected or to get paid off by the military. And Korea is part of that. The Koreans put up with it because it seems, I suspect, I'm not absolutely certain, I think your question is good, why they put up with it. And we're certainly, one of the things that we're waiting to see today is when Japan finally, now with finally, after 50 years of it, a new government that is no longer in the pocket of the Americans, slowly, getting around to saying, look, we're an independent country. We don't have to have troops based on our soil. And moreover, we're getting tired of the local military commander showing up at our Ministry of Foreign Affairs to apologize for the latest rape, the latest insult, the latest outrage in which the Americans were, as usual, behaving as if they owned the country, or that we are still talking about the end of World War II. All of these things are a long, long time ago. They should have been thought about to be gotten rid of. I'm sorry to say, in Mr. Obama's election campaign, it never seemed to cross his mind that it was time to be rid of this stuff, and that if you were talking about a country that was in the kind of economic difficulties we are right now, nobody in his right mind would understand why they keep 700 military bases around the world that are basically sort of spots for American soldiers to enjoy themselves.
Professor Johnson.
Oh, no, just a minute. There was another question, too.
That's right, regarding mercenaries. That's right.
Well, it seems to me that we've had that's a very important part of the world because of our long history of treating Latin America as if it was our backyard, as if we could treat it as if it were a dependent nation. The Latin Americans are today, as it easily demonstrated, quite independent of the United States, tired of it. Some of them, like Chavez and others, are extremely outspoken and independent. And this is not independence in the same old sense of Cuba from the days of Fidel Castro and things of this sort. It's exciting, I think, to see it. It is also getting to be richer all the time. And tired of the continued presence of the Americans claiming to be doing drug interdiction, even though the rest of the world would say, why don't you people learn how to control the Americans who like to smoke cocaine. We don't happen to think of cocoa as a drug. It's something that exists in the high Andes, and people who have lived there for centuries have used the stuff basically to tolerate the high altitude and still work. Things of that sort that is not treated in our country. That our drug czars turn out to be wearing military uniforms with three or four stars on them. And that this kind of thing has gone on endlessly and is increasingly not being tolerated. That's what is slowly, inevitably shifting in the world, and why it seems so boring to listen to American generals today talk about wars in Afghanistan and elsewhere as if these were things that we were inevitably going to win. We never win any of them, and we know we're not going to win it. It is a place for an American soldier to be sent to die, and you can't blame him for being irritated by it. He is certainly not contributing to the rest of the world to deal with a landlocked country in South Asia that doesn't want us there, with a very different religion, and that pompously goes around claiming that your freedom depends upon the United States. This is what's wrong. It is particularly wrong, though, in Latin America, where they have a very long, interesting history that they know quite well of America pushing them around, in some cases occupying their states, very often working on the side of the radical right, of the fascist right, as they have for so many years in places like Central America, have led to catastrophic issues. Whereas we could so easily have done this better, gotten along better, been more helpful in difficult things like the Chilean earthquake, or for that matter, the earthquake in Haiti.
Our guest, Professor Chalmers Johnson, joining us on the phone today. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Charleston, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Chalmers Johnson.
Okay, Professor Johnson, I appreciate your efforts, and I probably would agree with just about everything you say with limited knowledge that I have, but I want to go back to about 5 minutes ago. You were talking about China.
Yes.
And I guess I'm thinking the way superpowers manage themselves, you were kind of complimenting China, but wouldn't they act just like the United States if they could get by with it? I mean, I use Tibet as an example, so I'll go off air and listen.
Now, say that again, please. I'm not sure I fully understand you.
He asked, caller, I think he hung up, but Professor Johnson, he was asking about China. If they could, wouldn't they be just like the United States? And then the second part of his question was, specifically, he was talking about Tibet and their actions there, and doesn't that demonstrate what an empire they are, too?
Well, that's certainly possible. It's not something that we wish to see. It is not something that we think the Chinese are inclined to do, that they seem themselves, having been on the receiving end of imperialism for so long, to realize what is involved, and that also how quickly they discover that they antagonize people when they behave in an arrogant or supercilious manner, as if they were the new world. This is something, it seems to me, that the Chinese have learned. They may not have learned it perfectly. It may not work out perfectly. But we don't see signs of China talking about war in outer space and the determination to influence the entire planet through extremely modern and unimaginably lethal weapons. That moreover, the Chinese have uses for their funds other than simply pouring them into something as useless as military weaponry. The military does not contribute to productivity. It doesn't contribute to conservation. The Americans who believe that our economy is aided by our pouring money into the military are simply ill-informed. They don't know enough economic theory or, for that matter, economic history. So that I don't see any reason why China has to behave like an empire. And moreover, it's the longest continuously extant civilization that we know. If there are any human beings who have experience of the cost of arrogance, of empire, of pushing people around, telling them that we are telling you what you have to do, it is the Chinese, and they should understand what the costs are. I believe the Chinese are themselves overdoing it on materialism. That in some ways they seem more Marxist today than they ever were in the past, that they're truly devoted and relishing the world of material things, of prosperity as they see it, of their huge environmental problems and things of this sort, which are caused by their extremely high-speed growth. But there's nothing else to do but watch it and try and assist them. I don't think it helps for us to try to tell the Chinese, as if we were a modern empire, that you must do this because we Americans demand it. That is just as guaranteed to create its opposite, to create antagonism, as anything I can think of.
Professor Johnson, the point you've made several times now about this massive military spending, roughly $1 trillion per year in federal spending, being damaging and undermining the health and vitality of the American economy rather than being a supporting part of it or a key part of propping it up, has been an issue that I've had several economists on this program over the last few years, and it's come up a number of times. And to my surprise, almost all of them, including at least one Nobel laureate, has not jumped at that in the way I imagined they would and said, yes, this is a real issue. And in general, the consensus, and many of these are Keynesians, is that this military spending does indeed prop up demand for products. And without it, our economy would probably be, in at least in the near term, in dire straits.
Military Keynesianism, it's an extremely interesting idea. Not a phrase that Keynes himself ever used. Was invented during World War II when we discovered in this country that we finally got out of the recession, or of the Great Depression, because of huge military spending for World War II, and that led us after the war in SC 68 and other famous documents of our strategy in the Cold War to devote ourselves to building new industries such as nuclear submarines, satellites, one thing after another, that for which there was no human demand of any sort, or for that matter, even military demand, but it was certainly a way of spending money. I mean, I could actually make the case throughout the entire Cold War period from around 1950 to the times that we began to dismantle the system in the late 1960s. We spent well over $1 trillion on atomic weapons. Atomic weapons were useless. They are particularly useless today. We've known that they were never to be used. They never have been used. They're a perfect example of Keynesianism, of the government pouring money into people out of work just to give them some make work, to dig holes, things of this sort. That's essentially what nuclear weapons are, and here we are again. No other nation is, but we're talking about buying a new set of nuclear weapons even, that we think all of a sudden something with a little greater accuracy or a little greater speed or something of that sort. We continue to buy airplanes that are worthless. They simply fly too fast to see what we need to see things on the ground. Our aviation is counterproductive to our military activities. But that's to get off into something else again, into sort of strictly military affairs. It is simply to say it has never been established that military expenditures have any contribution to two real sources of wealth, consumption or investment. Moreover, they have effects that are very hard to measure, of draining our scientific labor away from productive investments, for which we could definitely use them, and things of this sort, in order to work on laser beams and things of this sort that we don't need and don't work even.
Our guests.
In fact, they're there primarily simply for, as you say, maintaining employment in places in my state, in California, or numerous other places where they make helicopters or ships or whatever else. No other nation does it. It does not contribute to economic development. It doesn't really contribute to the success of the economy. And these are the things that we ought to be changing out of. To say that there are Nobel Prize-winning economists, that may be a commentary on the Nobel Prize, but to say there are Nobel Prize-winning economists saying that we need to keep up this investment because otherwise our industries will collapse, well, this is simply farcical. It's the kind of thing that happens whenever the Secretary of Defense gets an idea of closing a few military bases. a perfectly logical thing to do for bases that we no longer need, that have been in existence for way too long and things of this sort. But just let him try it. You will hear a howl from Congress you never believe. How dare you close our base? We have to get together to maintain local jobs, schools, blah, blah, blah. And this is what's wrong. This is why if we don't, as a matter of public policy, start cutting back on this huge military apparatus, it's going to cut back itself on its own, and we're going to end up a rotten country.
Our guest, Professor Chalmers Johnson, you've just been listening to. This is Media Matters. We have a couple callers who have been waiting very patiently on the phone lines. Let's go to them.
Sorry, I shouldn't talk too long.
No, no, please keep talking. We enjoy it. Let's go to our callers forthwith. Line 4, Matt Toon, you're on the air with Professor Chalmers Johnson.
Oh, a couple of questions. Do we still have a line of bases south of Russia along a major pipeline that runs through Turkey to the Mediterranean?
You know full well we do. That's why you're asking.
Well, I thought we did.
Yes, exactly.
Are some of the countries there along trying to get rid of us, trying to close those bases?
They all plan to get rid of us, but they're waiting to do so. You don't want to go to war with the United States. It's a war that you wouldn't necessarily lose, but there's a good chance you won't. The Americans are armed to the teeth, and it would also be fantastically and lunatically expensive, so that it's easier to tolerate it and let the Americans continue to march around and show off how much they love militarism.
Well, isn't this the sort of thing that Eisenhower warned us against, this military-industrial complex?
Eisenhower was a genius
there?
On that subject. That is to say, it goes back, in a certain sense, to military men who have been presidents. The first one, George Washington, in Washington's farewell address. We keep forgetting how there was a time in this country when Congress was opened by the reading of Washington's farewell address, in which he spoke of the dangers of excessive military expenditures, of what this does to the tax base, how it shifts power to Washington, D.C. from the states, how it is ultimately utterly destructive of the federalism on which our country was built. Washington, it turns out Ike was right, but we just didn't pay attention. It's now too late. It's over the hill. What he warned against has happened.
Any other questions, caller? Well, I think we lost. Let me just follow up before we go to our next caller, Professor Johnson, on invoking presidential quotes. One of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's famous quotes during World War II at the beginning of the war was that he didn't want to see a single millionaire created by the war.
Yes.
He wanted no war profiteering. And
he loved the suburbs of Washington,
well,
these days. And
it seems like we're almost in the exact polar opposite world today, where, as you put it, the sole purpose of this empire we have now is to create millionaires.
Well, it is something like that, there are huge vested interests. We know full well it's a gimmick that when a new weapon system is bought, we come up with devices to extend a part of it to as many different congressional districts as you can find. I live in the 50th District of California, from which the former Republican Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham was arrested and sent to prison for soliciting bribes from the military for useless things like computerizing the plans for the Panama Canal and a few other harebrained schemes of that sort, people have begun to believe that we are dependent on the military. They don't provide nearly as much employment as education or health care would, for example. They are not things that we need. We don't get anything new from them. Americans are also have become overwhelmed by the whole world of secrecy and everything else, earmarks, all the rest of it, that's associated with this devotion to militarism. It is the dangers of militarism, which is not the same thing as national defense. I am not at all opposed to securing the United States against external threat or the attempt to use military force to coerce the Americans to do a foreign will. But that's not the issue, and it is extremely unusual that we would ever be subjected to that anyway.
Our guest, Professor Chalmers Johnson, author of the Blowback Trilogy and the forthcoming Dissolution of the Empire to be published by Metropolitan Books this summer. Let's go to our next caller, Peoria, line one. You're on the air with Chalmers Johnson.
Hi. I wanted to ask about the privatization of the
Excellent
military
point.
Bases and the
yes.
military, like, for instance, KBR.
Right.
And is this a creeping issue also?
I think it's extremely important. It's almost impossible to overstate the dangers that have come about of subcontracting our national security, our investments in weapons and things of this sort, to the private sector. The tremendous power of companies like SAIC and other companies that have, or for that matter, even the Blackwater Company, things of this sort that have gone beyond the military chain of command, that make it impossible to perform military functions without invoking private sector companies. You can't imagine how extreme it is today. When I was in the Navy back in the Korean War, we used to, as we were beginning to get new radars and things of this sort, we occasionally had a contractor from the private sector on board to help our sailors operate the damn thing because it was too complex and it often broke down and things of that sort. Today, it's simply beyond belief the degree to which the military is dependent upon contractors telling them what to do, where to go, running things. And we've seen these issues come up. That is, at Abu Ghraib, we actually saw private contractors being hired by the Pentagon to come in and torture people that we had captured in Iraq. This sort of thing ought to be discussed in this society. We ought to understand it better. Moreover, there are unimaginably highly classified things that are today subcontracted out, and there's more money to be made to be working in the private sector on these things than there is working for the CIA or the Defense Intelligence Agency or whatever else, as everyone knows. I mean, that is, if you work in one of these companies, you know of any number of people who have recently retired from industry in order to absorb more money as a private contractor working for dying corporation or whatever else it may be. You're absolutely right to say it's a growing problem, but probably the greatest danger, and particularly on Mr. McChesney's program, that the media simply doesn't do the job. They never report how many issues that almost any of us would consider of governmental importance, of governmental significance, of this is what we have a government for, that are in fact subcontracted out of the government into the private sector today.
Professor Chalmers Johnson, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, the host here on WILL AM 580. And it is a good time, I think, to turn to politics and the political debate on this issue a little more tangibly. Has the Obama administration, Professor Johnson, in your view, taken a position on the issues of bases, of U.S. role in the world, of war and peace, of the military-industrial complex, that is tangibly and importantly different and a step in the right direction compared to the former Bush administration or compared to what the McCain administration might have looked like?
Easy answer is no. I mean, I have to admit candidly, I voted for Obama. I was enthusiastic about how it was time to bring in a new government, things of this sort. I've been truly mystified by the inability to pay attention to what our government is actually doing. I can't think of any reason why we have a former director of Central Intelligence as Secretary of Defense today. I just simply don't accept the idea that there was no other Secretary of Defense that could have been appointed other than Mr. Gates. It's and I think that's a scandal. And the consequences show up all the time. We credit him for getting rid of the F-22, when the truth of the matter is anybody in his right mind would have gotten rid of the F-22 a long time ago. We simply can't afford it. It is meaningless to have an airplane that flies at Mach 2 that's supposed to be used to aid the armed forces fighting on the ground. You can't see them at that speed. Much less bomb them. And so that, needless to say, our so-called allies in Southeast Asia are always telling us that we've just been bombing friendly Afghans, friendly Pakistanis, friendly Indians, whatever else it may be. And we almost surely have been, too. Our generals very slowly, very reluctantly begin to acknowledge it. But that, you know, we are bringing the thing down. It actually sounds like the Wehrmacht in Russia in 1942.
You know, it's recently Thomas Friedman in the New York Times wrote a column basically saying, for all the problems we had in Iraq, it looks like we did win that war. That was, we can chalk that one up in the W side of the ledger, because it looks like we might somehow have some semblance of a credible civil society and democracy there.
If this is a victory, I'm afraid the word doesn't mean anything anymore, but go ahead.
Well, actually, that's you dive right in. I just wanted to ask you to comment on that assessment of the Iraq war. And you know, what your take on it, its historical evaluation will be?
Well, it's simply incredible. I mean, if they really believe that the justification for the war was weapons of mass destruction in the hands of Saddam Hussein, which is absurd, it turns out it wasn't that at all, and given the amount of money we spent on the intelligence services, the fact that we didn't know that is not just a scandal, it's an outrage. But that, of course, we didn't need to invade a country in which we know so little about, in which we were so naive about, in which we seem to fail to understand the elementary divisions of Islam, one of the great religions and one of the great civilizations of the world, and that we've been paying a price ever since. I hope and pray that something slightly stable does begin to emerge in Iraq. I keep awaiting the day when the Iraqis, who must hate us until the end of time, begin to retaliate against the United States. They have to do it for their own self-respect. But this is precisely the kind of things that militarism leads to. Do we really envy the Nazis? Do we want to end up the most hated people on Earth? We're certainly trying.
We've got a couple of callers waiting, so let's try to get to both of them before the program ends. Our guest, of course, Professor Chalmers Johnson. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Let's now go to line four, Portland. I assume Portland, Oregon. You're on the air with Chalmers Johnson.
Hi, Professor Johnson. I greatly appreciate your work. I'm curious what you say to those who contend that the world needs an intervention force of last resort to repel aggression in the way the U.S. military played that role in places like Kuwait, Somalia, and the Balkans over the last 20 years. And also, do you think the United Nations can credibly play that role?
I wouldn't mind trying harder with the United Nations than we actually do. I don't think that it's clear that the only thing that could do this is the use of armed force to intervene in another society to tell them what to do. I would simply put it in terms of what would we do if the other nations of the world, Europe, East Asia, whatever, decided to intervene in the United States to occupy downtown San Francisco, let's say, and decide to tell us what we better do in the future. We don't need our thoughts any longer. It just isn't plausible. It's what we mean when we talk about taking diplomacy seriously, taking foreign affairs seriously. Our problem with foreign affairs is that people who know anything about the United States don't think of diplomats, they don't think of scholars, they don't think of missionaries, they don't think of people doing aid work. They think of young men, 18 to 23, armed to the teeth, primed to believe that they are the march of good on earth, that anything they do will be okay or at least will be understood. I just simply don't buy that any longer. It seems to me we've given it as much of a test as we possibly could have, and it's proven to be limping in every instance. That, moreover, we are certainly not the only people to see that. That is to say, the British, I have admiration for the British decision of 1947 to liquidate the empire. This is what I'm believing that we should begin to do today. They didn't do a beautiful job of it, but they did it, and they deserve credit for it, and they're an honor to the world and to Europe for having done so. It's high time we start doing things like that. But when you look back on and see the number of people who will go to their grave hating the British, you'd think we would be forewarned.
Our guest, Chalmers Johnson, we have time for one final caller. This one is from the Netherlands. Line one, you're on the air with Professor Johnson.
My wife happens to be Dutch.
Is that so?
Yes, she's from The Hague.
Yeah, I guess it's daylight time already in the U.S. So
yes,
I'm sorry that I crashed into the program very late. My question is about Afghanistan. Have you been talking about that yet?
Right.
Oh, you have?
Please go ahead, caller.
Oh, I could ask another question.
Yes.
No, ask about Afghanistan. It's the heart of the matter right now.
The Netherlands are leaving Afghanistan after a so-called build-up mission that lasted 8 years.
Yes.
And that means we're done there, at least for now.
I hope so.
But it took a cabinet crisis to get our men and women back home. But
Right. Still,
over the years, I have heard little or no insightful explaining or analysis as to what the West is doing in Afghanistan. So that's my question, Mr. Johnson. Why do you think we are there? Politically, strategically? And thank you so much for giving your thoughts. I'll hang up now.
Thank you very much, caller. And Professor Johnson, if I may, we've only got like a minute and a half left, so maybe the condensed version, if you could.
Sure. We continue to sit athwart the world as if nothing could happen, nothing should happen, nothing will happen unless we're there, that our Secretary of State or whoever else has put in their oar at some conversation. That's what we're doing in Afghanistan. We don't need to be there. It is a totally landlocked country. If it were ever a military threat, to stress those words, we have the means to deal with that without sending an expeditionary army of young Americans who don't want to go. What do you think we've got 11 carrier task forces for? They can lay off shore and fire if need be. We have the most amazing air force there is in terms of bomber capacity. It's not what we particularly need, but we certainly have that. I just don't see that there's any reason why we should be involved in a landlocked nation in which we caused the problems anyway by our overreaction to the Soviet invasion. And that's the Soviet, referring to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan back in the past. We made movies about Charlie Wilson's war, which are just simply junk, and that we're paying the cost of it now. I think that I was so hopeful that Obama would not escalate. In fact, he is escalating, adding new troops to Afghanistan. I think there is no question that history tells us, dating from Alexander the Great, that the Afghans know how to defend their country from foreign invaders, whether they are British, Russian, or American.
Professor Chalmers Johnson, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio. Could you just real quickly, when is the new book coming out, and what is the title?
The title is Dissolution of the Empire. It's a collection of essays I've written in recent times, essentially talking about the contradictions, the conundrum associated with the huge American military presence around the world and what militarism means to us.
Thank you very much. I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, Melissa Trentz, the producer. And thank you, dear listeners. We'll be back in 167 hours. Till then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Our forecast calls for a chance of scattered flurries yet today and tonight. Then tomorrow, mostly sunny. It'll be chilly, though, to start the week with a high of 27 today, a low of 10 with wind chills in the single digits tonight, and a high near 23 tomorrow with the wind chill between 0 and 10. will be up near 50 by Friday with the chance of rain. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.